This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In December of 2010, 8 young people died in a New Orleans warehouse fire. Local accounts describe them as homeless squatters. One of the victims was Katie Seminer, a 21-year-old who told her mother she was backpacking across the country. Marty Gosley Jaramillo joins us now on the phone from her home in Alliance, Nebraska. Thanks very much for being with us, and we're so sorry for the loss of your daughter.
Thank you very much, and it's my privilege and honor to be here today.
Where did you think Katie was?
Well, I knew she was in New Orleans, and I knew she was traveling. She had set out on an adventure, and she was in Portland, and she had gone down to Northern California with a set of friends, is what she said, and that is indeed what she did. And she was traveling around and just seeing sights, you know, just wanted to get out there and have adventures and see the world.
She didn't tell you, though, she was riding the rails.
Well, at that point, she wasn't. And, I have received her journal since her death, and that confirms that. And I don't think she had done that until maybe she got to San Diego or Arizona. But, no, she never did reveal to me that she was hopping trains from time to time.
And how much about her life did she tell you?
Well, she told me quite a lot. A lot of her talk was mostly in philosophies, you know, and things that I have learned from her journal that I got after she passed.
One of the things I gather confused you a bit is she told you that she'd learned how to cook over an open fire down there in New Orleans.
Exactly, yeah. And I would ask her, well, Katie, why would you have to cook over an open fire, and why would you have to learn how to make coffee over an open fire? I wasn't clear on that, and any time I would question her, she would, you know, become sharp and say, Mother, I don't have time for these questions. I only have a short time on this phone.
and the other thing was you kept hearing trains in the background.
Yes, exactly. I was like, why do the trains, I mean, you sound like you're on a train. We're just live really close to the tracks. And, of course, after seeing all the videos and the fire and whatnot, I noticed that they were definitely right next to the tracks.
For greater access, I guess. And
yes.
The warehouse was a convenient place to live, and a bunch of kids, not just your daughter, were living there. And she was really, I guess, part of a community, but a transient group of people who connected and reconnected and knew each other, sort of. But what did you learn about this kind of life from her writings?
Well, if you would allow me to, I could read a short excerpt from her journal.
Sure.
Okay. Well, it starts off, it only takes about a minute or so. It says, time has flown by so fast, it's easy to get swept up in the lack of normal responsibility. In the last week, we stayed in an amazing squat, so much good food and living room picnics. 7 of us at one point, as well as a dog named Hamburgers. We were on the 5th floor of a very nice apartment complex, making it easy to keep our filth and debauchery hidden from our society and police. The fancy apartments across the way could see straight in, and I wondered what they must have thought of us. Maybe some envied us, some disgusted. I'm not sure. I know I felt a little sorry for them. Most of them must have been trapped in work and bills. They are the kind of people that take 20 pills a day and ignore their kids. I wanted to tell them they don't have to live that way, but who was I to say what they should do? Maybe they were happy that way. That was just a little excerpt from, you know, what she was thinking at the time, which I always found was kind of ironic because, you know, that's just how other people look at other people.
Sure. She mentioned her own the depravity and filth that she lived in, and I think to some degree ironic, but I think there's some truth to that too.
Yeah.
Do you think she was happy?
Oh, I know she was, and I can remember one of the last conversations I had with her, and she said, you know, Mom, please don't, you know, what did she say? Don't frown on my lifestyle, please. If you did, I just don't know what I would do. And I said, well, Katie, as long as you're happy, that's all I care about. And she's like, I am happy. I'm happier than I've ever been.
Marty.
What's a parent to do?
Well, worry, I suspect, is.
I suspect, yes.
I think
but, you know, her motto that she always stuck true to was, I promise myself to never stop living life in its adventure. I want to wake up every morning with a smile on my face and go to bed every night exhausted. And I know she lived her life completely that way. And everyone that came in contact with her remembered her beautiful smile and her bright spirit, and it lives on to inspire all of us to live our life to the fullest, and to love your family and to accept them for who they are and just be grateful for each and every day.
Marty Gosley, Jaramillo, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing the story.
Well, if this is your story as a parent or as a runaway, give us a call. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, a case for Turkey's government as a new normal in the Middle East. But first, Katie Seminer's story came to our attention through journalist Danelle Morton. Her daughter was part of this tribe and agreed to be her mom's guide to allow her to tell the story of the people who died in that New Orleans warehouse fire. She published her article in the Boston Review, and Danelle Morton joins us now from member station KQED in San Francisco, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
And I have to ask you, I'm sure you talked to your daughter, was she happy when she was a transient?
I think most of the time she was happy. I think she was happy to be completely free. I know there were many an evening when it was uncomfortable for her and where she wondered where she was going to get her next meal, but as they always say, as many of them said in New Orleans, you're looking for your survival and you're doing it with your friends, so every day has this kind of intensity that you can't get in the regular world.
And intensity that blossoms friendships much more quickly than you could find in the quote-unquote real world.
Almost like being a war correspondent, where there's danger all around and you form a very tight bond with the people that you can depend on.
War correspondents know what they're getting in for. Do you think all these transients do?
I do. I think, you know, there's a difference between being part of this group and being just a homeless teenager who lives on the street. This has a society, it has a community, it has a structure to it. It's almost like a tribe. And when the kids travel across country, they do so in groups of maybe three or five or six sometimes. And when they roll into town, they always, one of them knows like the bar or the cafe where you can go and hang out and find a warm couch to sleep on or a place to throw down your sleeping bag, because you're all connected in this kind of underground world.
After the fire, the local papers described those who were killed as homeless, as runaways, and you talked to people afterwards when you went back with your daughter to find out who they were, that others of this tribe resented that. They said, no, we're artists, we're musicians.
Well, they and many of them are, but I think mainly they were concerned about the notion that people were dismissing them as just sort of drunken, tattooed bums, when in fact this is an affirmative choice. It isn't something they fall into because they make a mistake. They actually say, I want to live this way. This is this life has its own, I don't think many people from our world would say values, but it does have its own sense of structure and value.
There seem to be a lot of drinking and tattoos, though.
Well, yes, I think they go together.
And other drugs as well. I mean, it's one of the kids you wrote about was, in fact, someone who was prescribed medication, and his friends cheered when he stopped taking it.
Right, and you're talking about Jonathan Guerrero. He was diagnosed as bipolar, and he was taking lithium. And, you know, when kids start to flirt with this lifestyle, their parents become very concerned, and many of them take their children to therapists, and the therapists put them on antidepressants. So a signature act of rebellion when you leave home to embrace this life is to say, I'm not taking those drugs, because they just dull you. They make you unable to experience the world around you, and I'm just going to break free of all of that. But illegal drugs and alcohol are very commonplace.
And people self-medicate, and sometimes those prescription drugs are necessary. I mean,
well, we think lithium for bipolar is pretty necessary.
Yeah. So there is also, as you said, an element of real danger in this. You kept worrying all the time your daughter was gone that she would die in a fire in a squad.
Well, not just a fire in the squad, although that was one of the major things I worried about. The train yards themselves are very dangerous. There's about 500 trespasser fatalities in the rail yards every year. They tend to cluster in the ruined parts of the country. In New Orleans, there's 42,000 abandoned houses. They live in these abandoned houses in the worst crime area of New Orleans. So it isn't just the danger of the squat, but it's also the crime and the railroad mistakes that can be made because you're drunk on a train. So there were many, many ways that one of this crowd can end their lives.
But that danger, you say, is also part of the attraction.
Well, I don't know if danger, yeah, danger is part of the attraction, but it's also this kind of radical freedom where they're not responsible to anyone, their money is not important, they live for free in squats, and they get their food out of dumpsters. And they have no need of money. There was one young woman that I interviewed in a squat who pointed to $3 that were sitting on a crate next to her mattress and said that that $3 had been on that crate for 3 days. She had no need for money.
Need for a clinic from time to time, though.
Well, there's, you know, it's an unclean world, and it isn't easy to get a bath if you're living in a squat with no water. So very virulent infections like MRSA are common, and so there are frequent emergency room visits.
We're talking with Dan O'Morton, a freelance journalist, author of A World on Fire, Life and Death in a New Orleans Squat, published in the Boston Review. If you go to our website at npr.org, there's a link to it there. We're talking about the lives of transients with Danelle Morton. This is your story, if you ran away, if your child did, call and tell us about it, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. The 8 young people who died when the New Orleans warehouse they used as a squat caught fire and their fellow transients who survived came from all over the country. For the most part, they weren't homeless because they had no choice. It was a wildness that led them to the lives of nomads, hopping trains, diving in dumpsters, and skirting the law. If this is your story, if your child ran away, if you're a runaway, we want to hear from you. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Danelle Morton is our guest. She wrote A World on Fire, Life and Death in a New Orleans Squat for the Boston Review after her daughter Marissa shepherded her through that world 2 weeks after the fire. And let's see if we can get a phone call. We'll start with Linda, and Linda's with us from Charlotte.
Hi there. I'm a physician in my late 50s, and just after college in the mid-70s, I went to New Zealand with no money, no plan, and no idea other than I wanted something entirely different than what I'd had. I stayed in New Zealand for roughly a year, taking very odd jobs, trips by way of hitchhiking or walking or borrowing bikes. I stayed on communes. I slept under bridges. I slept out in wood breaks. I slept in people's barns. And I would say, in fact, it was the best thing I ever did just for myself. I learned more about being resilient, about problem solving, about surviving, and in fact about appreciating everything around me and living in the moment. I also genuinely became inspired to become a physician by that experience, in part because I was exposed to so many different types of people, so many different lifestyles, so many different stories and settings that it was that actually stirred me to come back and do medicine, because I thought I would be surrounded by fascinating stories, and I have been.
That's interesting. Why did you decide then to go back to school?
Oh, because of this annoying need to be successful.
What did your parents think about this?
My parents were terrified when I did this, and I think embarrassed and deeply, deeply concerned. But after I got back, and after I had been so capable for the first time in my life of being completely independent and managing my everything that I needed to manage, they bragged about the experience in New Zealand for years afterwards, much more than they bragged about me being a physician. And I would have to emphasize, I think the outcome looked at in hindsight changes whether you think it was a risk or a benefit.
Linda, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Good question, too.